Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are 2/4 of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in 4 dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Why do Americans take a shower?
When do British people eat an entree?
And why do I pronounce court and court the same?
From vocabulary to idioms and pronunciation, we're here with another British versus American English episode of Words Unraveled. Are you up for it or down for it?
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we're back with another transatlantic showdown.
Yep, once again, this is British English versus American English. I mean, we say versus, or verse, as some Americans prefer to say. But really, we're comparing. And I think sometimes we'll come to conclusions that one is doing it better than the other. But I mean, a lot of the time we end up with this sort of flannelly confusion, which is, well, they're both fine, aren't they?
Right. Just different. Just different. I would like to introduce us with an entree, as a matter of fact, is a good example of that. What is an entree? When you go to a restaurant, what is an entree?
Well, it's your starter.
It is not a starter here.
What do you mean? It's your entry into the meal. It is your starter.
What it should mean. Oh, yeah. And that's what it originally meant. But it doesn't. Not in North American English. It is the main course in American English.
Is it really?
Yeah. If you see entrees on a menu, it will be the biggest food on your table. Bigger plates, more expensive, the main thing you eat.
This is why Brits always come home from America saying, the portions over there are enormous, because
maybe
they think they're ordering like a tiny prawn cocktail and what they're actually ordering is an enormous shrimp salad.
Oh, I wonder. And it does make sense. Entree is identical to the word entry. It should be the first thing you eat. Now, why we say this came around in the early 1900s for like thriftiness and fashion purposes. I've got 2 quotes, one from Good Housekeeping and one from Boston Cooking School magazine, that explain when it changed, basically, not necessarily why. So the word entree is usually, in French cookery, a dish introduced between 2 courses in a formal dinner. So you have the earliest course, and then you have the entree, and then you have your main course, and then you have dessert. But in the early 1900s, Americans started saying that an entree could serve instead of a main course. So you could have a little something at the beginning, something in the middle, and then go straight to dessert. The way Good Housekeeping put it was, a tasty entree with a good soup at the beginning and a nice dessert at the end may appear in the middle of a family dinner and fill out a most satisfactory bill of fare. And then the Boston Cooking School magazine said, up to within the last 10 years, maybe even a shorter time, an entree or a side dish was thought of principally as a dish served between or in conjunction with the main course of a dinner. But now the entree may supplant these main courses in like the modern era.
So what seems to have happened here is a conflation of 2 different French words, right? You have entrée, which is to enter, and you have entre, which is French for between. And the only difference is, well, you've got that accented E on the end, or 2 E's at the end of the one meaning to enter into, and then entre, which means between. So, ouais. I just said ouais at the end of there. any good point about French, I could enter with ouais.
But that's a good point. No, it seems to be like a conflation of those terms, but then also the fact that there were traditionally four courses and then they were compacted into three.
I mean, I think we've covered the various permutations of the French terms for parts or rather meals of the day, and the fact that dîner and déjeuner both mean ultimately to break your fast, and that, you know, dîner has just been moved so far up in the day that they've had to bring in déjeuner earlier to remind you to break your fast earlier. And then they've had to bring in petit déjeuner as déjeuner has got later and become lunchtime. Petit déjeuner is now breakfast. And it's a terrible, terrible mess, but not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about British and American English. And what you've hit on there is an instance where we're using the same word, but we're just using it for something different, which isn't what we always go into on these. Normally we would go, oh, look, you call it this and we call it that. But here it's a different beast, isn't there? And there are a few of these, aren't there?
Another one that totally baffles me every time you say it, which you say it very frequently. You say, I'm having a shocker, and I have no idea what that means. I know, I get it. I get the idea that you're having a bad week or a bad day, but I don't know why you mean that, because that doesn't mean anything like what shocker means here.
It's really telling that you've heard me say that a lot, because normally I get on the call and go, I'm sorry, I'm late. I am having an absolute shocker. And you've hit on what it means. You've interpreted it perfectly correctly. And I can't give you any more of an explanation other than it just means you're having a shockingly bad day.
That's got to be it. It's just shocking seems so much more dramatic than what you're describing. Like, you're like, I'm having a busy day.
Yeah, it does come from, like, that idea of shockingly bad, right? So yeah. It's an exaggeration, which is kind of interesting, because a lot of British terms versus American terms tend to be more understated, I would say. Which brings us to another really key one that we do need to talk about, which is the word quite.
Right. So that means it's kind of an intensifier here. If that's quite good, it's very good. But that's not what you mean, right?
I'm so relieved you say that, because I got an email today from an American that said, Rob, I quite like your videos. And I honestly took it as a sort of backhanded, like, negging comment. And then I thought, I'm going to ask Jess, could that quite mean that they really like them rather than
they really like your video?
That's a relief. That is a genuine relief. Because if we say something is quite good, we mean that we're not going to go so far as to say it's good, but it's pretty good would be another way to put it. I was looking this up, by the way. I mean, the American usage of the word quite is the original, insofar as that is what the word means once it enters English from French. It is an intensifier. It means sort of, extremely severely, but it changes meaning just in British English to, rather than being something having a lot of a certain characteristic, to it just having a bit of that characteristic. So rather than quite good meaning very good, it comes to mean, you know, it's a bit good. But it is... It's our bad, basically, that one, to use an American term. It's our bad, because we're the ones that have decided to use the word differently. You could call it British understatement. I don't know. I'm calling on a stereotype there. But yeah, we did that. Sorry.
It's a little flexible here, too, because when you say, I quite like your videos, it sounds like you're being cute when you say it like that. It's like, it may not be a thing that you would say in everyday conversation, but it might be a thing you put in an email. There's also, I think it's used in sort of the same way when you say not quite, you know? Obviously, it's a very different context, but like, is this correct? Not quite. It's a nicer way of saying no. Or not precisely is what it means there too.
I was just looking at some research actually from 2018. The title of it was carried out by YouGov, which is a polling agency in Britain. They might be in America as well, actually, now I think about it. I'm not totally sure. The headline they've gone with is, half of Americans wouldn't be able to tell that a British person is calling them an idiot.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, so what it boils down to is that there are different interpretations of certain phrases either side of the Atlantic. So, for example, the findings from this survey where they asked Brits and they asked Americans to say, you know, how would you interpret this phrase? So with the greatest respect is one of the phrases that they tested. And they found that a majority, like 68% of Brits, heard that as meaning, I think you're an idiot. So if you say to someone, with the greatest respect, before you then make a point, you're actually saying, I don't like you. I think you're a moron. Let me put you straight. Whereas actually a minority of Americans interpret it that way. Half of Americans interpret it as meaning, I am listening to you. So a genuine sort of mark of respect. It's very similar to when people say, with all due respect, which is a very similar sort of idea. They also tested, I'll bear it in mind. If during a discussion, someone says to you, you know, you make a point, and then they say to you, okay, I'll bear it in mind. And how would you interpret that normally, Jess?
Very genuinely. We were talking about quite a minute ago, and that can be used as a softener, like quite ugly means not quite, not very ugly, but all of this is a little more earnest. The American versions of these are more genuine in their interpretation, more literal.
That is the general takeaway from all of these. You're absolutely right. Because in the case of I'll bear it in mind, 55% of Brits said it meant I've forgotten it already.
Oh, no.
I don't care. Whereas it's about 40% of Americans thought that, but another 40% actually slightly edges it. So it's 38% versus 43% thought it sincerely meant I will, you know, probably do what you have said. They also tested, I hear what you say, which Brits interpreted as, I disagree and do not want to discuss it further. Whereas Americans in the majority took it as meaning, I accept your point of view and you must come for dinner. Now, this is an interesting one. So most Brits interpreted you must come to dinner as it's not an invitation. I'm just being polite. So
that's like
57% of Brits think that.
We should get together sometime is also the, we probably won't ever see each other again.
Exactly that. It's a nice thing to say, but you don't expect anyone to follow through with it. To be fair, 45% of Americans also interpreted it as meaning, you know, it's not an invitation. They're just being polite. But a similar proportion also saw it as potentially meaning, I will send you an invitation soon. Whereas only a third of Brits thought that it was a genuine invitation.
You might genuinely end up in a situation where you say you must come to dinner and someone will ask when.
I mean, it's perfectly reasonable. I hang out here in trendy Berlin with lots of Europeans who take my words far more literally than I intend them. But you have to adapt to that. I mean, it's perfectly reasonable for people to take words as meaning what they mean rather than this subtext game that Brits are playing.
Some of these are very, they entirely depend on tone, because you could derisively and sarcastically say, I'll bear that in mind. You know, if you're arguing with someone and they say something, then you come back with, I'll bear that in mind. You don't mean it.
Yeah, exactly. Tone can make all of the difference, obviously. Give us some more of these words that mean something different either side of the Atlantic.
Well, what does it mean to knock someone up?
Well, it means to get them up the duff. Pregnant.
It doesn't mean to knock on their door, because of what I was, my understanding was in British English, to knock someone up can mean to knock on their door.
That would be a regional dialect, right?
Okay,
that,
all right.
We wouldn't say that where I come from. I absolutely know that there are parts of England where if you went to knock someone up, it did mean go knock on their door and get them to come out and play. I mean, you know, the ambiguity of that phrase versus getting them pregnant would very much be flagged if someone was said, oh, I'm going to go and knock Jess up.
Right.
Let's go, beg your pardon? Yeah, unless it was sort of out of the mouth of the babe, then it would be assumed potentially that you were intending to, well, get them in the family way. I've gone blushing. This wasn't supposed to be a blusher of an episode.
Is that a new idiom? Have we developed a new idiom here? Is this a blusher?
Rob's having an absolute blusher.
I love it. The impregnate sense is an American English variation originally. So that one has gone back across the pond.
That's interesting, because I was thinking of the film Knocked Up, right? And so that means pregnant. Okay. Also, to knock up is to play badminton or tennis with no stakes.
It has a lot of meanings. I was looking through the OED interpretations and definitions of this term, and it's like putting stuff on the wall, wrapping stuff around other things. There's one of the first uses of it was in like the 17th century in a book called Mechanic Exercises, where it meant just to prepare anything. in printing, for example, knocking up the balls was preparing these balls made of horse hair covered with leather that were used by printers. Yeah, exactly. Before rollers and whatnot.
Inking your, sopping your balls. Do you remember that phrase from our printing episode? To sop balls is to cover them in ink.
But you could also knock them up.
Yeah, well, I mean, if someone said, oh, I can knock up a sandwich, I would understand that to mean they were going to make a sandwich. Or if they said, oh, I can knock up a bookcase, I would understand that to mean they could put a bookcase together.
No one would say that here.
No. Okay, that's interesting.
No, it would only be the pregnancy sense.
Can I throw another, it's not an idiom, it's a word at you. Momentarily. So if something is happening momentarily, what does that mean to you?
It means it's about to happen.
I mean, I think now people would understand it as meaning that in Britain a lot, but traditionally it's definitely meant that it's happening for a very brief amount of time, like for a moment.
Oh, okay.
But the interpretation that you have in the States, it does come later than the one where it means it happens for a short amount of time, but it does derive from that in a sort of transferred way. So it's going to happen in a very short amount of time.
It makes more sense that the momentary thing is a thing that is happening for just a moment, not in just a moment.
But if a pilot said, we are landing momentarily, very confusing.
Very quick landing.
Well, then where are we going? You can let me off. By the way, I got a few of these from my friend Evan Edinger, who is an American living in London who likes to make YouTube videos about this sort of stuff. So I'll give him a shout out at this point. And he flagged up moot point as one that means something different either side. What does a moot point mean to you?
It's no longer relevant is what I would phrase it as. If that point is moot, that means we're not going to talk about it anymore because it doesn't matter to the conversation.
Whereas to me, it means we absolutely are going to talk about it. The point is, if the point is moot, it means it is up for debate.
Oh.
Traditionally, a moot is a discussion. It's a debate, right? In fact, it's what they would call like a town hall debate in olden times. And also, law students will hold a moot, which is like a mock trial. Basically, the difference between the British and American interpretation of that is the Brits say, oh, it's a moot point, isn't it? It's something we could be debating in a moot. Whereas Americans are saying,
let's talk
about
the
sort of thing
later.
We might debate in a moot, but a moot is not a real trial. So forget it. You know what I mean?
Or it could be like, let's meet about that later. Or that's not the purpose of this moot. That also explains why it's a common eggcorn in American English for people to say a mute point.
Yes.
Because that means, you know, it doesn't matter.
It may as well be silent. Yeah.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are 2/4 of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in 4 dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
What about engaged? Engaged over here typically means you are going to be married and that's it. And I guess you are engaged in an activity is used over here to some extent, but it's less often used to mean occupied over here.
I mean, we would use it to describe, like, say the disabled toilet is locked. You say, why is it locked? It's engaged.
That is not a usage we have over here. We do say, like, I have an engagement, which to mean I have an event to be at in more formal settings, though.
I wouldn't describe the toilet as having an engagement necessarily, but it is engaged. God bless it.
If someone were to say, hello, I'm engaged, it means that they're betrothed.
Oh yeah, that's it. Actually, you know, I'd forgotten this, but if you used to call someone on their phone and they And it just went straight to doot, 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 doot. We would describe the line as engaged. So what happened when you tried to call mum? Oh, it was engaged. It means that she was already on the line and therefore we couldn't get through. And this is not a thing that happens anymore. At least it's not how we describe it anymore. But yeah, that's a good old usage of engaged that I've basically forgotten about.
The etymology of this word makes it more serious than those more casual uses, because it means to be pledged into something, to be bound by a pledge.
Oh, right. So it's the same gauge as we have in mortgage.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And related to wage, right? It's just different French dialects give us wage and gauge. Love it when we get into that sort of stuff. Just stop me. Let's talk about some idioms that I wouldn't understand and you would understand.
Okay.
And awesome. I've, again, been trawling another YouTube channel for this, because there's a guy called his channel is called Lost in the Pond. His name is Lawrence Brown. He's a Brit living in America. So he's basically the reverse of Evan Edinger, and they've done little videos together. But here are phrases that he has found baffle Americans when he uses them over there. You'll know them because you talk to me, but I wonder how much the average American knows about taking the piss, for example.
That's a good one.
I mean, I have used that to Americans who have just gone to me, you're going to do what? are you taking a piss on me? They said, no, that's not what it means. It's not what it means. That actually did happen to me. I met American guy in Morocco. And I said, I'm not taking the piss out of you. He said, you're taking a piss on me.
What?
Like, no, but we also have taking the mickey, right? Which is actually derived from the Cockney rhyming slang for taking the piss, because it's taking a mickey bliss. So when we say taking the mickey, we're literally more politely saying taking the piss, which is, by the way, if anyone doesn't know, it means mocking someone.
Pissed is also has a very different meaning. Pissed is angry here. Pissed is drunk there, right?
Drunk as a skunk. Off your trolley. Yeah, indeed. Bob's your uncle. Do you know what? I associate the name Bob with America so much that I had assumed that Bob's your uncle was a known phrase in the States. Apparently not.
It is not frequently used. If you say, if we were to use it, uncle in an idiom, it would probably be crying uncle, which means if someone is beating you up, you're asking them to stop.
No way. I've never heard that. There we go. The American military have been very, very fecund when it comes to producing idioms, actually.
Very much so.
How about sling your hook? Would you know what I meant if I told you to sling your hook?
No.
I'd be telling you to go away.
Oh, why?
Sling your hook. Sling your hook. I think it's one of those ones no one knows precisely what it is. I think the most sort of believed interpretation of where it comes from is the idea of the hook being your anchor, and basically slinging your hook is hanging your anchor up and getting out of the port, basically. But yeah, get lost is another way we'd phrase it. I don't know would you use get lost in the States?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Oh, and another one we have is that we describe someone as losing the plot sometimes. I don't know if you have that one.
Oh, I like that one. That sounds like an internet neologism to me. So I wonder if maybe it's an earlier British term that has now become an American term because we are able to talk to each other on the internet now.
Yeah, it definitely goes way back, losing the plot. Yeah. And it can mean that you're sort of insane, or it could just mean you're confused.
It's also entirely possible that a lot of Americans do use that, and I just didn't encounter it until the past 20 years. Other idioms I would say that Brits might not have would be anything from American football or baseball, which we've discussed before, but they include like ballpark figure, batting 1,000, throwing a curveball, hitting it out of the park. I'm sure that these are familiar.
I mean, we do have all of these. We do have all of these now, though, because we've picked them all up through American corporate culture.
Do you have Monday morning quarterback?
No, I don't have that.
I can't say I hear a lot of people saying it, but it's cited frequently in like listicles of American idioms from football. And it's someone who criticizes or second guesses actions after the event. So your big football game is on Sunday, and then on Monday morning, you're talking about everything the quarterback did wrong.
If I can do a bit of sort of armchair sociology on this one, I think perhaps we tend to take on the ones where the words are not so specific to the sport such that it's possible that it has like a British origin, like to knock it out of the park. You know, there's no word in there that we can't relate to.
Right.
Quarterback, we're going to struggle with. Mm-hmm. And you're going to struggle to say a phrase with quarterback in it and not come across as pretentious. So maybe that's why we don't have that one.
There are a few others that are specific to American politics, like your John Hancock. Do you know what that is?
It's your signature, right?
And it's because John Hancock signed the Declaration of Independence in a particularly flamboyant way.
I wouldn't use it. I just happen to know because we're the sorts of people who look these things up. That's, right. That's why. Here's one that I did not know that Lawrence Brown mentioned as an American idiom. Behind the eight ball?
That one I actually looked up because I didn't know why we said this. It means in a difficult or losing position. The first reference we have in writing is in 1923 in the Buffalo Evening Times, apparently from the game of Kelly Pool, in which the players are assigned balls numerically higher than eight. Balls that are behind the eight in order have the possibility of winning, or from eight, or it could be from eight ball pool where you can't contact the eight ball on a shot before it is the legal ball.
I think it's the second one of those. That seems far more likely, that the white ball has nestled behind the eight, and you're basically, what we would say in English, what we would say in British English, sorry, is snookered. So to be snookered in the game.
That's
of snooker.
A game, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's from the game. I mean, it's from another form of billiards. And in snooker, if your white ball, the cue ball, is positioned such that you do not have a direct line of sight, or, you know, you do not have an easy shot at a ball that is in play, you have been snookered. So you've been put in a position where you're going to have to do something very flamboyant, bounce it off the cushions or whatever, to play a legal shot and not have to therefore forfeit any points to your opponent. So I think behind the eight ball and snookered have basically the same meaning in the two forms of English, and essentially the same origin. They're evoking exactly the same, you know, awkward position.
It being the cue ball in American English makes perfect sense.
And don't mess with Texas. I've no idea what's going on with that. Apparently it's a slogan, and it was originally an anti-littering slogan. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
don't mess up Texas. That's I like that one better.
I like it because it's more literal than you expect it to be.
I'm going to Texas next week, and I'm excited to go to the weird city in Texas, which is Austin, which is very artsy and fun, and has less of a chip on its shoulder than some of the rest of Texas.
You heard it here first. Jester Farris thinks all of Texas has a chip on its shoulder.
Actually, I'm going to get in trouble for that, but yeah, we're good.
This is above my pay grade.
All right. Plead the fifth. Do you all say plead the fifth? I know you wouldn't. Like,
Yeah, we don't have the Fifth Amendment. But I mean, if someone said it, I would absolutely know what they meant. But you have to, I mean, the key thing here is that and Brits are exposed to far more American television and movies than Americans are to British content generally, right? So I am more likely to have come across these things than you are to have come across the Britishisms. And I don't realize a lot of the time I'm using Britishisms. You know, something quite funny happened a few weeks ago. We had an advert. So we script the adverts ourselves. On this occasion, I scripted it. And at the last minute, we changed which of us, because believe it or not, sometimes they're scripted. We're not making it up as we go along. At the last minute, we changed who was saying which sentence. And I inadvertently had rammed the sentence I was supposed to originally say with Britishisms. And Jess was forced into potentially having to say, join a queue, and describe something as dodgy. The way Jess's eyes, as she came up to these words, was like, how am I going to tackle this? It's going to sound very wrong. But they should be, what is it, wait in line and... I know. When we describe something as dodgy, we mean it's shifty.
Shady.
Would you say shifty? Is
that shady, shifty,
shady.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sometimes don't realize that they're Britishisms. You know?
I also did this with Taylor Swift lyrics once. Taylor Swift has written many songs and is very popular among young women in the United States. And I taught a graduate class at Emerson. And I did not realize that I was saying things that Taylor Swift popularized.
What? Like what?
Like, hey, it's me, I'm the problem, things like that. I had seen it as just general online usage, and I just didn't know that that was a line from one of her songs.
Oh, well, these are the perils of moving with the times and being fashionable.
Zero criticism of Taylor Swift. Her music is fine. I even like a few songs. Just I don't listen to absolutely all of them, like some of the Swifties in my classroom who were like, oh my God, she's a Swiftie. And I was like, she is?
Oh, there you go. Kudos.
Wait, hang on. Is that how you normally pronounce that?
Yeah, we don't say kudos.
Oh, hey, we've stumbled across one in the wild.
No, but this is because this is a weird thing that I do not understand about American pronunciation. That when they see OS, it always becomes os, even like from Spanish. Like it's os in Spanish. Why do all these Spanish words with os at the end of them become os in? And you guys are so close to all of these Spanish-speaking places. I don't understand why this happens.
Kudos is different because it is a Greek word. And also we say kudos, so we do that even weirder.
Actually, we're there. Let's get into talking about some accent differences here because it's all in the vowels, isn't it? The differences between British and American ways of pronouncing things.
I don't know. I feel like the most obvious one is the rhoticity.
Yeah, but that's also all part of the vowel system, ultimately.
Right, fair.
Right? Because I end those words with a vowel. I don't end them with a consonant. So if I say letter, I'm ending it with a vowel sound and I'm not rhotically sticking a r letter.
Right.
Letter. Now you have to turn the T's and the D's. You have to swap those around. Don't you? So what we're talking very generally here about general American, or some people call it so-called general American, this generic American accent versus RP, received pronunciation. I mean, there've been various forms of received pronunciation. I don't speak RP, but the way I speak isn't a million miles off it. Mine's sort of northern tinged RP. So one of the big differences between general American and British received pronunciation is the rhoticity thing, whether or not you pronounce R's after vowels in that way. There are others.
Car versus car.
Car. Yeah, yeah. We have lots of these. Spa and car. They end the same way to me, S-P-A and C-A-R. And indeed, S-P-A and S-P-A-R are exactly the same word when they come out of my mouth.
And it's sometimes at the end of words and then sometimes just after a vowel, because there's like bird, for example, versus bud.
Porter, for example. Mm-hmm. You would say porter, right? Excuse my accent. But there are lots of interesting vowel bits and bobs going on, because you have mergers of vowels either side of the Atlantic, for example, to me. So let me just briefly introduce something called lexical sets. The key name you need when you're talking about these is a guy called John C. Wells, right, who is a linguist. And in 1982, he wrote Accents of English. And in there, he created this list of words that can be used to compare general American and received pronunciation based upon the vowel sounds in those words. So the words were, I won't do all of them, but they were kit, dress, trap, lot, strut. Now, each of those has got a different vowel sound in them. And it's very helpful to take those words, get the people speaking different accents to say them and compare how they say those words, because it gives you an idea of how they will say other words that contain those vowels, like the goat vowel, which is pronounced in received pronunciation with a sound at the start of it before the ooh sound at the end. Goat, right? Goat. Whereas in American or general American, it's goat, right? And it starts with a sort of rounding of the lips at the start. But from this, you can work out how between the two accents, I'm talking about RP and general American, which vowel sounds are merged, right? For example, three of the words from Wells' lexical sets are north, force, and court. I pronounce all three of the vowels in those exactly the same. They are merged. Whereas in some accents, both in Britain and in America, north, force, and court are pronounced in ways where the accents are different. So can you say those three words for me?
North, force, court. So I say them the same, but I can imagine.
No. So do you know what's happened here? You've interpreted the way I said court, because I have a non-rhotic accent, as C-O-U-R-T. But
what
I was actually
say?
Saying C-A-U-G-H-T.
Caught. I see.
Yes, exactly. So you say caught, right? Mm-hmm. And you have a cot court merger. So you pronounce the words cot and court the same. Whereas for me, the vowels in court, C-A-U-G-H-T, north and force are the same. And incidentally, that also means that court, C-O-U-R-T, is also the same, because that is not in the court group, that is in the north group.
Do you say Mary as in the name, Mary as in the emotion, and Mary as in the as in marriage the same?
These are all different in RP and in my accent. Mary, Mary, and Mary all sound very distinct, but in most American accents, there's a merger of at least two of those three words, if not all three.
Mary, Mary, Mary.
Are you fully merged?
Yeah.
Of all three?
Mary is Mary because she got married.
Oh, that's adorable.
I guess Mary, getting married is a little bit wider, if
yeah,
I'm thinking
that
about
is
it.
Like, that's, mm-hmm. that's one of the really key mergers, is the Mary, Mary, Mary one, and that cot court one that we've somehow stumbled across. That was one of the, I've got that in my notes as one of the big ones to mention, like the ways in which the different accents differentiate between certain vowel sounds and others just include them as the same vowel. But you get a lot more mergers for, you know, non-rhotic accents like mine, just because the R, the sort of R colouring of the vowel sound that rhotic accents, when they pronounce that R, have, just makes such a big difference. And if you get rid of that, then loads of words are exactly the same.
One thing that's a little bit different here, shifting to a different type of pronunciation difference, is two syllable verbs ending in A-T-E, like donate, rotate, and dictate. Would you mind saying those?
Donate, rotate, dictate.
So you put the stress on the second syllable. So we've got a difference there.
After I heard you say them, I found it really hard to switch to how I would normally say them. Because I mean, it makes perfect sense to do it the way that you do it. Rotate. Rotate. What would I say? I can't even remember what I'd say now.
You would say dictate and I would say dictate.
You're putting the emphasis on the first syllable and I'm putting it on the second.
Yes, that's what's happening. And then the second, what's funny is we do the opposite with words ending in airy, eerie, or airy or ory, A-R-Y, E-R-Y, or O-R-Y, like military, for example. You would soften the last part of that, right?
Well, I would clip it, maybe. I might say military.
Military, or inventory.
Inventory.
Testimony.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That is proper, like, classic British vowel clipping. Yeah.
Laboratory or laboratory.
Laboratory. Laboratory.
The tree on the end.
Library's an interesting one, actually. And we're really, really taking the mick with that one. We're skipping all kinds of letters at the end. Library. Library.
Right.
You could just spell it L-I-B-R-Y and we'd be fine with it. Library.
Just skip that middle part. It's not important.
Yeah. I mean, I have heard Americans try to do a British accent and overdo that and say like laboratory or library. And it sounds very strange to hear that embedded in a sentence.
It is always funny when Americans try to imitate a British accent and roll their R's. One of the reasons it happens, my understanding is that originally it was because it would be, say, between two, a word that ended in a vowel and a word that began with a vowel.
Right.
Wanting to create some sort of stop there. I think that happened. I vaguely recall an elderly relative doing something similar, and she was from Virginia.
That's interesting. I mean, we do have that intrusive R that we will slip in between two vowels when there isn't an R sometimes, just to help us navigate words. What's a good example? Law and order. That's one. Yeah. That is something that weirdly only non-rhotic speakers do, but mm-hmm. we stick an R in there to help us, whether or not they're, you know, there is an R at the end of the first vowel. Here's something I've just realized, that when I was having a go at Americans for pronouncing loss or whatever as los, I just realized that that's because that oh sound is quite alien to to most American accents, right? It doesn't generally turn up in them. And that's why one of the key tells of an American doing a British accent is that they will struggle with words like dog, lost, fog. It'll come out as dog, lost, fog, which, yes, there is a form of received pronunciation where that is how it's pronounced, but that hasn't been spoken by anyone born within the last sort of 70 years, I'd say. Yeah, that's one of those tells. I'm sure there are lots of tells for a British person doing an American accent, but that's the one I always notice for Americans doing British accents.
In American English, we often downplay the ending on words that end in I-L-E, like fertile instead of fertile.
Right, yeah. So you're almost clipping it yourself there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Missile, hostile. And, hostile, which is pronounced the same by some people, whether it's a place you stay or you're being hostile.
Oh, yeah, that's funny. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah. Hostile, yeah. They probably have the same origin, don't they? Like hostel, hostile, hotel,
I mean, I would
host.
Be willing to bet that's ghost. Why they named the horror franchise Hostel, is because it is a double entendre.
Oh, I missed the joke all this time. It's got to be that, though, hasn't
it? It's
got
to be, yeah.
Right? Was it set in a hostel? But even so, it's like...
I have seen that movie once and I was like, so...
You didn't.
I like horror movies, but body horror is a little much for me in that one.
I think I would still say missile. Would I still say missile? I mean, I might say missile as well, but definitely those are the ones. You've hit on something that's definitely a difference.
Just to close this out, let's talk about some slight phrasing changes we have. Like, you would have a shower and I would take a shower.
Would you have a bath or would you take a bath?
Take a bath.
Yeah, I would always have a bath.
When you're doing a test, what are you doing?
I don't know if I would say take a test or not. It's one of those things where I can't tell whether that's
just
from American influence or not. We would sit a test.
A difference here, you would go down the pub. I would go down to the pub.
There's a song, we're going down a pub. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When I was doing that, I would say, I could go for a beer, but that wouldn't mean that I was going anywhere necessarily. If I could go for a beer and just pull it out of my fridge.
Yeah. Okay. But we would be going out for a beer. Here's a difference. In American English, you might say, I'll see you Monday. Whereas in British English, would be more like say, I will see you on Monday.
On Monday.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I get pulled up a lot by American viewers is that I use different to. I'll say one thing is different to another.
When I used different than,
yeah,
some folks lost their minds in the comments one time.
So basically American English has different than and different from, and British English has different from and different to. And I maintain that I use different to and different from differently to one another. I find it really hard to describe why. Just one of them feels right and the other one doesn't. But yeah, people do not like different to. I've learned this.
I think the logic behind, or the gripe with different than, is that both of them are comparative words, and so you don't need to reiterate the comparison.
I mean, different from makes to me the most logical sense. And that's the one that we all use. Different to, when I think about it, it does seem a bit odd. Like when you're comparing two things, when you're stressing how they are not the same, how they differ from each other seems more logical. But different to is definitely a thing that we say.
Similar comparative words also typically use from, like apart from.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, yeah. Very good point.
And then similar to.
It differs from. I mean, you probably could say it differs to. No, you could.
Could you?
Yeah.
That doesn't
sound
right to me. But I mean, what do I know?
What a mess. Jess and I are different to each other. I would have done it differently to you. But I could also say Jess and I are different from each other, or I would have done it differently from you.
Either way, we could address more of these, but we should cut off for now and we should do this on a different episode. Are you down for it or are you up for it?
I'm up for it.
I'm down for it.
Oh, I like that one. Fantastic. I always enjoy these little transatlantic sparring matches. S-P-A-R. You see, sparring. You see, we pronounce the R on spar when it becomes sparring. Yeah, we don't pronounce it at the end of a health spa.
Excellent.
There isn't one.
We'll be back with another one of these next week, and then in the future, we should.
We should do. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, everyone. This is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes. So, for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.